Yeah, I mean, you got to do the work, and as you mentioned, they specifically selected a binary system so that it would be much easier to detect what kind of change the collision affected. You know, if it's just an asteroid sitting there and you bang into it, it's a little bit more subtle, the changes, than an asteroid that has another smaller asteroid circling it. So, you know, asteroids, meteorites, they're all fun things. But, yeah, I mean, you need to test models. So that's always a very important aspect. In some cases, you can do it. In a lot of cases, you can't, just to this day. You know, when we talk about the solar activity and the sunspot cycle, we're using these theoretical solar models that are utterly, totally unproven. They're you know, trying to take little bits and pieces of scientifically detected data, Parker rockets data and such, to kind of prove the modeling. But it's a real slow process. So we have a lot of things that have models that are not terribly well proven yet. So there's a lot of room for improvement. Well, once again, this remains AC2GS. Anyone with any comments?
I'd like to thank you, gentlemen, for actually digging into thoughts that I throw out and pondering them thoroughly. I appreciate that. KD2BHD, saying thank you.
Well, you're welcome, Jim. You know, I mean, you asked it. It deserves a comment in some way or another. Hopefully, me and Ed could serve giving some kind of useful thoughts on the subject.
And you do.
Okay, before we call it a night with the first segment of the Technical Net, I think I will share with you a brand new, shiny new grip. I'm always looking for grips. You know, there are, you know, one of the oldest ones is the Nigerian prince who emails you that he has a bank account of $6 million, but he can't get it out of the country, so he's going to send it over the country in your name, and you can keep $5 million of it, or something along those lines. So I get all these grips all the time. So I recently discovered a shiny new grip. I got this email from a company that said it was the Chinese domain control agent for the Chinese domain name. So all those names that end or have a .cn in them supposedly is registered with this company. This company registers these things for a fee, and they're renewable. So if you want limark.cn.com, for the Chinese members of Limark, you go to these guys. So I said, they send me an email and they say, we just recently got this request for some domains that happens to be the same beginning as your domain. I have something like rslaufer.com. So they said, well, we have someone who's applying for rslaufer.cn.com and three or four others. And we'd like to know if you're associated with them, because it's not right that they should take your name or your brand. So I figured I'd test them, and I said, no, they're not affiliated with me in the slightest. Let me drop for a sec. So then I get an email that purports to be from the company that's trying to register half of my name in the Chinese domain server. And they sent me an email saying that we really don't care that you used it first. We want to use it, and there's nothing stopping us. Then about a week later, I get another email from the original company that says that they're the domain registrar, that says they feel terrible about it, but the only thing that I could do is register the Chinese domain myself for a nominal fee, and I should contact them about determining how much this is going to cost me. So that's the nature of that particular grip. They take your domain, They slap, they say they slap CN.com on it, and then they tell you that otherwise someone's going to pirate your identity if you don't pay us to get the Chinese domain version of your domain.com and such. So it's a delightful new grift that may or may not be Chinese-based. You can never tell. They may be spoofing China entirely. It could all be in Russia, who knows. So I found a new grift for all you people. So if you like to collect domains, and I must have at least 15 at this point, then watch out for strange Chinese emails asking you to register Chinese domains.
Wait a minute, Roy, I saw it.
Yeah, sure, Ed.
Isn't R.S. Laufer a very common name in China?
Exactly, yeah, that's why it kind of smelled a bit. It's not even that common in the country. I mean, that, you know, it's not like I registered that domain, you know, 3 weeks after .com became an entity. You know, it was sitting around. It's not, surprisingly, there are not that much R.S. Laufers out there. The only one I found so far is a stockbroker in Israel who I guess doesn't want to have a personal domain.
Question and one YDY.
Yes, thanks.
So, is it even in the same character set? I mean, don't Chinese characters have a completely different physical appearance?
The word is Kanji.
I thought that was Japanese.
For the sake of the domain registration, I think they do it in English or European. They don't do it in Chinese characters, I don't think.
Japanese has kanji stolen from Japan, katakana, and hiragana characters. It's a whole mess.
Yeah, yeah, but it Chinese also has a multiple different character sets. There's, I think, standard, and then there's simplified. At one point or another, Mao had a lot of curious, weird ideas, and I think he wanted to do away with the entire Chinese alphabet, which would have made an old friend very happy. He was a Chinese-American, and studying how to read and write Chinese gave him a great deal of headache.
A thought?
Yes, Jim.
Wasn't the internet invented and built by the Chinese so they could do what they want with it, or is something else the case?
Well, I hope not. I mean, in the old days, that was usually the thing going with Russia. You know, Russia was television. The first television was invented in Russia. The first radio was Russia. They even made a joke on Star Trek. They had Walter Koenig, who played a Russian character, repeatedly misbelieve that everything was invented by a little old lady in Stalingrad.
May I ask a
remember
question that we probably already dealt with once, but I might not have been here for it. It relates to the submersible that was lost not too long ago.
Sure, Hank. Yeah, we brought it up the last week, but yeah, well, you could bring it up again.
Well, my question is simply, is there any proof that this guy actually, or the CEO actually used a qualified engineer at any point in the design of this, or is it strictly something that the guy did himself?
I did read something the other day.
Yes, Ed, one second. The problem is that the more you look into this, the more it gets confusing because he doesn't really tell a lot of truthful things. So, you know, you'll hear him say that he had input from Boeing, and then you have some reporter ask Boeing about it, and they'll tell you that they didn't talk to him about anything. Now, he could have had a chat with a Boeing engineer who's passing him in the park. I guess that's possible, but you know, to a degree, I wouldn't be surprised if corporations are kind of shutting down on the whole subject, even if they had anything whatsoever to do. So it's going to be very difficult to retrace this guy's steps. The only thing he's really legitimately left behind were a lot of emails and messages that basically said, life is risky, I'll take the risk, and I'll survive. Just watch me. Which some people with a weird sense of humor just found amusing.
WD2EAD has some comments on that, Roy.
Feel free to comment, Ed.
What I was going to say a minute ago is the following. I just read the other day that the electrical and electronic systems on that submersible were designed by a batch of interns who I believe had not completed their college education yet. So I think that gives you a hint of the level of professionalism. Now, Roy, for Boeing, as I understand it, the relevance to Boeing was they decided to use carbon fiber, and Boeing had some carbon fiber that had, to use a popular consumer term, you know, gone past its sell-by date. So they bought it up cheap. And using it in a submersible after it has passed its, you know, lifetime is every bit as bad as using it as an aircraft under those circumstances. And no less a highly academic expert as James Cameron, the movie director of Titanic, who after Titanic became quite an aficionado of submersibles, learned a lot about that. His summary was, I was mortified. Does that answer any questions?
Well, I saw one of the videos of James Cameron. Let me make sure I have the repeater. Okay, I saw that. He had a lot of things to say. There were a lot. There is a relatively close submarine hobbyist community, as weird as that might sound. And they were all clucking and warning everyone. And there were so many danger signs. I've heard a whole bunch of stories. Boeing seems to be doing a Sergeant Schultz for anyone born before 1960, and they're doing one of those, I see nothing, I know nothing, you know, not even about the carbon fiber, the out-of-date carbon fiber are they going to fess up to. So it's going to be difficult to connect the dots, but I'm sure people are going to write books and people are going to make documentaries and all kinds of terrible things. But it was a travesty. Everyone sort of knew it was a travesty, and it was almost a joke. There was one episode of there was one submersion where the idiots put the motors in the wrong way. So they had to figure out how to change the settings of the game joystick so that it would work with mispositioned motors. Otherwise, it would spin round and round and round and go nowhere. So, I mean, these guys were jokes, unfortunately, and it wasn't funny.
You're aware of the joystick issue?
Well, yeah, they used the Logitech joystick. Most of the guys that report on the story who know technology didn't weren't that upset by that because joysticks are probably a good type of design interface for something like a submersible. But the idea that you had to reset it according to a mispositioned motor because you didn't want to waste the time of taking the motor off and putting it in the right place during a submersion.
You can't go outside to sleep in.
Not in the amount of time. It was one of those publicity things, so they dropped it into the water, they turned it on, and instead of going forward or backwards, it went clockwise and counterclockwise. So they didn't want to pull it out of the water and change the and put the motor in the right place, so they just rigged the joystick to send the signal so that it would go in the right direction. Instead of the wrong direction, you know, it was a bunch of, you know, it was a very bad situation comedy going on.
Before PhD.
Yes, Jim.
So the technical discussion may cover the whole story, no doubt. I remain interested in the human part of the story. Like, what was the motivation to cause this? This wasn't just a guy popping wheelies on the Belt Parkway. There was huge motivation here. Maybe he was just a whack job. I'd like to know more about that.
He was a... Let me see if I have the receipt. Okay. He was a deeply entitled man. His great-great-great-great-grandfather, two of them signed the Declaration of Independence, I think. You know, he comes from ancient money, not old money, but ancient money. Grandparents who were in the fossil fuel industry. A grandfather, I think, that ran a kind of elitist society around San Francisco that rich people and presidents and ex-presidents still hang out to this very day. So he was born in bushels and bushels of money. People must have impressed him with the idea that he was brilliant when he wasn't. And he died of a severe case of hubris and greed. He was going to monetize this submersible technology, not just to people, tourists, thrill seekers. He was going to he told people he was going to make a bundle. He was going to be another billionaire selling this industry to fossil fuels and the military and all kinds of different places. So this is just a very, very severe case of death by hubris, in my humble opinion.
Can you describe a different viewpoint of the same thing?
Certainly, yes.
It's you, SCP.
Okay, I doubled, unfortunately. First Ed, then the other gentleman that I didn't hear the entire call sign.
I'll wait. Sir, go ahead.
Okay, go ahead.
It was Chris, K2SCP. I have a different view of this. I was a big wave surfer years ago when I was a young man, and somewhat of a thrill seeker in some ways. And I knew very well when I did it, the risks involved. It was very dangerous. I was in very dangerous situations, and partly why I stopped doing it. And I look at this guy and people that did it as they're just thrill seekers. And not big wave surfers, not unlike the guys that jump off of cliffs in wingsuits that look like a squirrel. They're absolutely insane. I don't know how they do it. But, you know, there's lots of ways of being nuts and crazy, and when you're dumb enough, like I was when I was young, you do things like that, and that's your own choice. I don't look at it as such a bad thing. The people were well aware of the issues. They signed the waiver that said you might die 13 times or something on the first page. So I just look at it a little bit differently. I say, the thrill seekers, they wanted a thrill. It didn't work out. I mean, part of the risk you take. And just lastly, I'm not sure if you mentioned it, but the transcript of the dive has been leaked. It's on YouTube if you want to see it, and it's pretty clear what happened. K2SCP.
I have a comment about that.
Okay, Ed, I'll give you time for your comment. I just want to throw out my own little comment. I don't feel terribly sorry for the adults in the room who flushed, who paid him, you know, $250,000 to die historically. I do, however, feel really bad about this kid. I think his first name was Suleiman. He's the son of a Pakistani billionaire. The billionaire was the daredevil, but because it was Father's Day, he snookered his poor son Suleiman into joining him. You know, so the two of them spent $500,000 to kill themselves. So I don't feel that bad about the father, but I feel kind of bad about the son.
Al?
Absolutely agreed. That was kind of ridiculous, but yeah, you got it.
All right, Alroy?
Now, Ed.
When you were going crazy surfing, you never took a paying passenger with you. The guys jumping in the swirl suit, never take a paying passenger with them. That is an incredibly huge difference.
I don't know, so what? I mean, there are times we paid guides to take us to places we couldn't get to on our own, so, you know, if I had the money back then, I would have paid it to go places and be in places, so I disagree. It was my choice, and if I wanted to spend my money doing it, it's my choice. I just see them as thrill seekers and doing what they want. I do agree taking your child aboard, and apparently the kid didn't want to go in the first place, so talking him into it was ridiculous. I would never talk someone to going into big waves. In fact, we had people that said, I don't know if I want to do it, and we immediately said, don't. You know, if you're not 100% in it, don't do it. But, you know, the rest of it is, you know, was it design probably? Like, who knows? But he was a thrill seeker. You know, putting on a squirrel suit and jumping off a cliff ain't the smartest either.
Good comment. Can I come in?
Okay, Ed, then Jim, you doubled. So first Ed, then Jim.
I don't think most people realize the amount of testing that any serious platform, airplane, especially military, boat, especially a military submarine, goes through. These things, everything is tested endlessly, sometimes for years, and there's a reason.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what frosted Cameron's nuts. He kind of said, you do not have paying customers endanger their lives using untested equipment. You want to do it yourself? Fine. Don't take money from crazy people to get themselves killed. That was, I think, the major aspect of James Cameron's complaint. Not that he was doing the dives himself. If he wants to kill himself, so be it, but that he was actually selling the service to somewhat innocent people who didn't realize what a flake the whole thing was.
K2STP, I agree there's some truth to that, but in my case, I would do the research myself. There was people that said, try this, and we looked into it, and I said, there's no way I'm doing that. That's just stupid. And these people, if they're billionaires, should be smart enough to do this themselves. But that's just my view of it. I don't know.
I think billionaires overrated.
Yes, if anything, Elon Musk has put an end to the concept that billionaires are brilliant. Billionaires know how to be billionaires. That's about the only thing that being a billionaire proves. They are not particularly the brightest, light on the in the light bulb store. This kind of demonstrates the same thing. There's a kind of strange craziness in some ridiculously wealthy people. They start to believe their own public relations releases, and then everything goes to hell. Jim, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, it's an interesting conversation, and I suppose I have a different interpretation of it, and I don't have a conclusion. I'm not saying I have a conclusion, but I spent a lifetime taking risks of extreme scales, and for much of it with other people's lives, and I get paid for it. They get paid for it, but we push the envelope of survivability many times. We had good reason to do it. The big wave surfers, their reason to do it, it eludes me. But as was stated previously, that's their prerogative. Involving other people definitely changes the equation, absolutely, especially if they're paying custody. All that stuff, it's a complex thing. But myself, if somebody asks me, you want to go skydiving? Jump out of a perfectly good airplane for no particular reason? I have no interest. If I have to jump out of a perfectly good airplane to put on a forest fire, yeah, I'll do it on crutches. So I wonder what the motivation was. Something's missing from this equation as I see it.
I see there's a parallel to Mount Everest.
Well, yeah.
There's sort of a lot of that same among people, especially there's a whole group of people who are Titanic freaks that they mortgage their house to pay for the trip down and risk their lives just to be near it. In the same way that other people see a mountain and they have to climb it and such. But again, people can endanger their own lives. It's a free country, I guess. But when you're selling it and you're not testing the equipment, I mean, hopefully in the cases of mountain climbing, you're using equipment that has been thoroughly tested and doesn't put you at risk, whereas this entire submersible was completely untested. And it had a fault indicator that gave you, I think, about 10 seconds of information. So it would go beep, and 10 seconds later it would implode, which really doesn't give you much of an opportunity to do anything except to say, what was that beep?
CP.
Yes, Jeff? No, I think I got it wrong. You, Chris?
Okay, I thought somebody told. That's actually a great example, the mountain climbing Everest. Everest currently costs somewhere between $150,000 to $350,000 to have a guy bring you there. You're not allowed to go on your own. And those guys, I mean, equipment is an oxygen bottle and you bring your own warm clothes. And they have no idea what your health is or if you're going to survive it, and many people don't. A large portion of people are dying up there. And, they're thrill seekers. They want to climb up for whatever their reason is, and they're handing a lot of people a lot of money to do it, but it's their own survival that whether they make it or not.
Should I tell you my comments on that particular one?
Certainly, yes. We're going to have to wrap it up soon. I feel terrible about delaying the space night report.
This will be short. On top of Mount Everest, you cannot survive. What you can do by sheer force of willpower, you can force yourself to survive long enough to make it to the top and back down where it's a little bit better, as long as absolutely, positively, nothing goes wrong. If anything, no matter how small, goes wrong, you die.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I heard this semi-absurd story one of these famous YouTube stream whatevers who decided he was going to go up Mount Everest, and apparently he went unconscious halfway or three quarters up there, and his Sherpa had to carry him on his back all the way down the mountain, and this guy was so pissed that he bust his cred that he blocked the Sherpa that saved his life.
One, that was below the really dangerous zone. It goes to show, by your description, it goes to show it was nowhere ready. And second, that is just an unbelievable level of entitlement and idiocy that makes this guy with submersible expense.
Yes, indeed. Welcome to 2023. He didn't hit the top. I guess if you hit the top, there's really little chance of anything being survivable. But if you go up, you can come down. You don't necessarily succeed, but you can go down. But we live in a very entitled, weird world these days.
I got another thought.
Okay, Jim.
So there's probably a lot of people that fit the question I'm going to ask, but have any of you out there gone into a situation where people have died people are dying, and more people are going to die. And rather than slowing down your step, you increased your step to get there quicker. And I'll follow it up if there's any answers to that from there.
Okay, I heard Ed say no, and someone who was very audio was distorted. I couldn't make it out. So the person who wasn't Ed, you want to try again?
Might have been me, Chris Fireman. I said that reminds me of a fireman.
So I'm going to see if I have it. Having made that step a number of times in my life, I ask when these things happen, what is the motivation? What is causing this person to do this thing? Bungee jumping off a crappy bridge with a worn-out bungee cord is idiotic. I would never, ever do it. Yet I've done things you would never do. I calculated the odds. I trained for the eventualities. I made decisions that I had to make it for, you know, half a dozen other people. And there's people that are way better at it than me and people way worse at it than me. But I want to know, what was the motivation? Nothing of all this technical stuff means very much. What was this guy trying to do? I don't find the other information very useful without that metric.
Well, I don't know what to tell you, Jim. From all that I've read on the subject, it sounds like he just wanted to be one of the cool billionaires like Jeffrey Bezos and Brant. What is the guy who does Virgin? Companies and such. He just wanted to be a cool billionaire. He came from a very, very rich family that you know, buildings are named after relatives of his, and he just wanted to be a member of the tech bros. You know, him and Elon and Bezos and such. I think that's what it comes down to. And he had very poor risk-benefit assessment skills.
2XDP.
Yes, Chris.
My answer would be his motivation was money, and by him, I think you mean the guy that was doing the sub rides, let's call them. I think he envisioned he was going to do this with this little sub with five or six people, whatever it was, minute, and he was going to get enough people and build a giant sub, like a nuclear sub the size of a 747, and stuff 500 people in there at $5,000 or $10,000 a head and go down there three times a day with hundreds and thousands of people and make big money. That's how I saw it.
Well, according to the interviews I heard, he was much more crazy than that. He thought he would be able to license this technology out to government, to military, to defense, to oil interests, all over the darn place. He was going to make a bundle eventually with this. He was starting off with the Titanic nuts, but he was going to brand the place. Anyway, it was a fun conversation. Let me make sure I have the repeater. Okay, seems I have the repeater. Fun conversation. Paul, I'm terribly, terribly sorry. I didn't mean for it to go this long. But without any further delay, here's WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
Problem, Roy, following this story is long. Very good. Terrific information. Great theories. And we'll eventually see how that submersible story works out. But it's a shame that they lost five people on this guy rolling the dice. That's all I can say. By the way, this is Paul WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. On the 13th of this month, there's supposed to be a possibility where the northern lights are going to drift further down down the latitudes much more than normal, which is unusual, you know, during this time of year. You know, you usually have bad weather, clouds and stuff, so if you have a clear night on I'm not sure about Long Island, but maybe upstate New York might have a shot. And they're also definitely predicting Vancouver out west, the possibility of seeing the northern lights. And that's, when I say they, it's NOAA, you know, the Space Weather Prediction Center is making this prediction for the 13th due to the sun being very active. It was active the other day, and they said that again, something similar happened. The K index, which you can get from the Space Weather Prediction Center, got up to 6 about a couple of few days ago, and now it's dropped back down again. But now I just see, you know, I just looked at it earlier, and it's starting to creep back up again. If it gets up to 5 or 6, yeah, you could possibly see it, possibly here on Long Island. I don't know about the city with all the lights and all, but, you know, definitely upstate and possibly Canada. But we'll have to see. The auroral activity is going to be probably high, and then within the next year or so, 2024 is when the solar cycle 25, you know, should peak. So we have a long way to go. WS1. Okay, I could zip through a couple of these topics real quick anyway. We have time. The Area 5 program by European Space Agency has finally come to a close. After 117 missions, they finished the other day. This was a heavy lift vehicle, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen tanks, solid boosters attached to it. You know, it was since 1996, I think, 97, it started launching from Kourou, French Guiana, and many missions, scientific missions, and most recently the Euclid mission just went up a week or so, Euclid went on Falcon 9, but recently the James Webb Space Telescope two Decembers ago, Christmases ago, they launched the James Webb Space Telescope. They also launched a total of 5 ATVs, automatic transit vehicles, to the International Space Station over the years. At the time, they would bring up the most payload, the most volume, the most weight, more than anybody, and they used to do this once every year or so. But that came to an end many years ago. It's supposed to be replaced by the Ariane 6. Naturally, before Ariane 5, there was an Ariane 4. And Ariane 6 should have come online by now, but there's been quite a few delays with that. So they're predicting maybe sometime next year for Ariane 6. They were hoping to do it by the end of this year. I don't know if they're going to make that. They've had some problems with some of the testing on the engines. So we'll see. Ariane 5 has come to a close. Every one of the missions, except for like the first one, they had some trouble, but every one was successful. They had a terrific record. Let me drop it. Okay. On this net, we covered the OSIRIS-REx program. That's the one that went out to the asteroid Bennu to collect material from the surface, which it successfully did about 2 years ago. And I've been following it ever since. It's scheduled to return to Earth on September 24th. You know, the called the mothership will continue on, or will drop off this unit has got now the material in it, and it's got a heat shield on it, and it will dive through the atmosphere and wind up in the Utah desert. As it comes down to the Utah desert, they had originally plans on having a helicopter grab it and for a more softer landing. I don't know if that's still in effect. I keep pushing back and forth on that idea. But anyway, it will eventually land in the Utah desert. And right now they have crews out there practicing. They actually have a dummy of this descent module. It's probably the size of maybe a half a refrigerator. And they'll eventually bring it back to Houston. They're practicing on going out and getting it, bringing it back to Houston. They have a whole facility in Houston to bring this in. No contamination, one of those deals, you know, similar to what they did for the Genesis program. When that thing came back from staring at the sun, picking up particles from the solar wind, Genesis came back and through the atmosphere, no problem. It was supposed to have a parachute that was going to open, and it didn't open. Somebody put the accelerometer in the wrong direction, and the next thing you know, it crashed into the surface. But the scientists, undeterred, grabbed a hold of this thing, little by little, over a period of time, brought it into a research lab to examine everything. And as months went by, they sure enough, they were able to find particles. So the mission really wasn't lost. So I expect good things from OSIRIS-REx. They'll be bringing back a couple of pounds of material instead of little molecules, like on Genesis. Or on, they had another mission as well. They went out to a comet years ago, and that was very successful too. But that brought back little molecules as well from the comet, from the coma surrounding the comet. Comet built, spelled with a W. Any comet. Okay, I tell you, I could go through these very quick. 63 days, the helicopter was not heard from. The helicopter is the Ingenuity helicopter on Mars. I remember Chris, K2STP, telling me about this a while back. Back in April, they had lost contact with the Ingenuity helicopter. But that was only for a week or so. And sure enough, they got the signal back, and all was well, and the helicopter eventually flew again. This time, now over 63 days, a little over 2 months ago, it took off, and it flew to an area. They knew they were going to lose the signal because it was going to drop below a ridge on a Jezero crater, and it did. But then they thought, well, eventually they're going to find it. You know, the probe was getting closer and closer to it. The way it works is the helicopter transmits some 70 centimeters, transmits back to the Perseverance rover. Perseverance rover in turn transmits up to one of the orbiting satellites, like Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. And MRO eventually transmits it back to the Deep Space Network on APE. I think it's the X-band. So this little helicopter was lost for 63 days. Sure enough, the rover eventually came over one little hill, and they picked up the signal. And it's doing well. So they're getting ready to eventually fly it again. Although they're starting to get into the Martian winter, which could be a problem. They usually don't fly things that much during that time frame. And during that time frame, it usually accumulates with more dust on the solar panels on the helicopter. You know, Perseverance, you don't have that problem. It's run by a RTG, a radioisotope thermoelectric generator that doesn't have solar panels. But the little helicopter does. So they might do a spin up to it where it just doesn't take off. By doing that, you know, it could vibrate some of the particles off the top of it if it starts to accumulate. But it's doing well. It was supposed to be able to do five no more than five launches. They were hoping that that's all they were going to get out of Ingenuity. Meanwhile, they're up to, I think this was the 51st flight of Ingenuity. Terrific success by NASA and JPL that put this all together. I believe Goddard was involved. Very, very well done with the Ingenuity helicopter. Any comments? This is WS2N. Okay. The Mars on Earth story. Well, that actually made the news. Put out on CNN. Where they have a crew of four people going into a prefabricated building. Actually, the building was manufactured using 3D. And the building's inside of another building, inside of an older hangar down in Houston. So these four people are going to go inside, and they're going to duplicate living on Mars for 378 days. That's the predicted time that a Mars team would be on the planet for that long. So they're going to see how they interact with each other, with the food situation. They're going to simulate, you know, the food that would be brought to Mars. And they're going to, you know, conserve our resources, water, oxygen,
time,
recycle
complete.
Everything, like they do on the International Space Station. And they'll run a test. There's been a number of these programs over the years in Hawaii, Arizona, you know, different. Utah is another one. But now they're going to do this one inside of a building, an enclosed building. Now, surrounding this 1,700 square foot building, they made it look like Mars, you know, so eventually these people would do an EVA, they'll put on spacesuits, and they have two guys and two girls, and eventually they'll go out two at a time, simulate walking on Mars. Of course, they can't duplicate the 0.38 or roughly one-third the equivalent of gravity that you have on Earth. They can't do that, but they could do, you know, other things. And they'll run a lot of experiments, and including communications. You know, if they want to talk to Earth, they're going to, you know, have like a 10-minute delay or sometimes a 20-minute delay to duplicate where Mars relations to Earth at a certain time. You know, it could be as close as, you know, 10, 15 minutes or a half hour away. So texting would probably be the best way to go. You know, we're used to that now. You know, you text somebody and, you know, you don't look at the thing, and maybe a half hour, an hour later, you look at it and send the message back. So that probably would be the way to go. Voice communications would be pretty tough. You know, they could do that. But, you know, you say, how you doing, and you got to wait 20 minutes to find out how they're doing. That could be very annoying. But we'll see. Physically and psychologically, how these people do. Any comments for the net? This is WS2N for the Space Net Report. Okay. The Starlink program is causing apparently some kind of RF interference. There's been a group, evaluating the possible interference, you know, for astronomers, and this test is being done, you know, in the Dutch radio observatory that's studying the interference that's coming back from Starlink. And, you know, they expect the normal, 10.7 and 12.7 gigahertz. You know, that's the normal transmissions from these thousands of Starlink satellites that SpaceX has put up there. But they're also getting signals between, let me drop it, between 110 and 188 megahertz. Well, right in the middle of that is the 143.05 is one of them that they keep hearing, but which is kind of strange. so they're trying to figure out what it is, what's causing it. Not supposed to be coming from these satellites, but it is, according to the Dutch Radio Astronomy Group. So any comments at all? WS2N. Okay, nothing much. I've already talked about the Crew 7 that will be going up shortly to the International Space Station. Crew 4, one of the people up from Long Island. We'll talk about that as we get closer to a launch. They'll be going up on a SpaceX Falcon 9 Dragon crew vehicle to the International Space Station for 6 months or so. Yeah, 5 to 6 months. That's the standard number. I'll stand by for any other questions. If not, we're going to turn back to Roy. Okay, that's okay. Roy, let me pass it back to you. We'll be on tomorrow night. And we have the Club Info Net that always comes on at 8:30, not 8 o'clock, like this net. That's always followed by Stop and Shop. AC2GS, WS2N for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
AC2GS, thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet Report. Thank you for all that you do here on the technical net and all that you do on the club. We all appreciate it. I especially appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone who participated tonight as well. I hope you learned something. I hope you were entertained. I hope you'll come back again next Sunday when we try and do this all over again. I've added a couple of articles to Roy's link. Again, to get to Roy's link, you just type in roy.ac2gs.com. And I've added the article about the transcript from the ship on the surface during the Titan sub disaster. Chris, K2STP, was kind enough to give me the link, so I gave it to you. And I have a link to an all-band antenna that Wesley was talking about earlier. So I hope you have a chance to look and read it. Well, our rebels now are done, guys. As I usually do, I got a couple of quotes to throw at you. Dick always used to end the technical net with the advice to be kind to each other. That's certainly good advice, so please be good to each other. I like to quote Epictetus, it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows, so keep an open mind and learn something new, or at least try to learn something new. So once again, thanks to everyone. Have a great week, and please, if you can, come back next Sunday at 8 p.m. when we'll try and do it all over again. This is AC2GS, formally closing this episode of the Limar Technical Net, and I am clear. Slava Ukraine.
Paul, if you're still there, I got a quick question for you, K2STP.
Hi, Chris. K2STP, WS2N, still here.
Hey, thanks, Paul. Hope you're doing well. Chris, I missed the very end of your statement on the helicopter. They lost it temporarily, or did they lose it forever? What was the end result of that recent loss?
Yeah, well, you know, I remember the article you sent me. That was the 1 week loss back in, a little over 1 week back in April. But now this one was 63 days, 6-3. So, like a 2 month loss. Flew away. They knew where it was going. They knew it was going to drop behind a ridge on Jezero Crater. Sure enough, it landed, at all autonomously, so no problem with that. And then it took a long time, Perseverance chugs along and it's doing science along the way. It's, throwing rocks, taking pictures, whatever it's doing. And time went by. Eventually they came up over a ridge and sure enough they picked up the signal from Ingenuity. So that's been saved, and they plan on doing another flight. They're going to wait a little while. They're going into the winter. So I don't know if they're going to do it soon, but anyway, they have 100% solid communications are back, and the science that and pictures that Ingenuity took on that flight, you know, they always retransmit it back to Perseverance. Of course, that was all stored in memory on the helicopter, and then they were able to you know, download that information, eventually send that back to Mars MRO, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and then of course that sends it back to Deep Space Network, and all as well. So, still doing good, Chris. Back to you.
That is absolutely unbelievable and fascinating. It's crazy. I can't tell you how many times I've used the line thanking NASA for doing it, because I say, somebody tells me they can't do something, and I say, come on, we have a remote control helicopter on Mars sending pictures back. We can do it. I just can't believe they got that thing. And I wish K2RIW Dink was able to see it, because I remember him having a lot of discussions about it ever working and whatnot. But all right, thanks, Paul. I appreciate it. K2SCP.
Yeah, it's got the two blades, and one opposes the other, opposite direction. And I remember telling him, you know, he was saying, how fast are the blades going to go? I said, well, it's variable. You know, they'll adjust it for the temperature, or, you know, the atmosphere. They can make it go faster or slower, but it's around a little over 2,000 RPM. And the blades are 4 foot long, you know? You know, he said, oh, no. He says, Paul, you got to check that, you know? I remember, I think I had to go to the NASA site or something to double check to see if that was true, if I had that number right, a couple of thousand RPM.
Yeah, I remember those conversations well, because it happened many times that discussion would come up. And there's another discussion I used to always have about the getting the water up the large redwood trees, 500 feet or whatever the heck they are, and the pressures involved, and he just discussed that. And I still don't quite understand how that happens, and that's amazing. Maybe Roy can explain that one to us one day. All right, I got to run. 7-3, thanks, Paul.
I remember the tree stories, and he says, these big 1,000-foot trees, whatever. He says, where do you think all that wood comes from, you know? And it doesn't come from the ground. It's from the air. It's that solid piece of wood, you know, going up hundreds of feet. It's all from the air, you know. I remember that story. I thought, wow, I hope he's right about that. And he was.
KD2VHD on the trees.
KD2VHD, WS2N, and Chris is still here.
I haven't been way up Northern California, but I've been enough of the redwood forests down south to have learned that a lot of what happens there is that there's moss that grows in the trees that captures the moisture from the clouds and the fog and all that stuff that comes in. And so a lot of what you typically think of a tree has to take everything in from the roots that's liquid and everything in from the air that's gas. Those big trees, the moss that grows on them captures the moisture in the atmosphere, and it gets absorbed into the tree up in its heights. Very interesting ecosystem.
Oh, okay. You're saying the moss has something to do with it, but those particular trees, but not your solid oak trees, something different. I guess I remember going through Muir Woods, they call it. That was all these big trees, too. Unbelievable.
That's exactly the place I learned about what I'm talking about. Muir Woods was amazing. And that characteristic is specifically about these large redwoods and whatnot on the Pacific Coast. I don't know if it's unique to that ecosystem, but very interesting. It's what brings a lot of those huge conifers to life over the eons on the West Coast.
Very good, Jim. Very good. Yeah. Talking about trees, I just fixed one of my dipoles while the G5RV came down the other day. pull the